Thank you. Did you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, and it's time to start.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. And I'm a little shy this class because I don't feel that I'm a scholar I don't feel that I'm a scholar of anything, but I'm really not a scholar of contemporary Beis Yaakov. And it's actually, I'm just at the beginning of my research into that subject. But I know obviously it's of great interest to people. And I did write, I don't know, 5 pages about it. So I'm happy to share what I know, but I really want to hear what you have to say and what you think. There's a lot of big questions I still have. I could talk about Beis Yaakov during the Holocaust, but let's start with, that's a whole other subject that I'd rather bracket for now. And you'll understand why I'm bracketing when I get to how the Holocaust is remembered. It's difficult to talk about how, what actually happened with Beis Yaakov during the Holocaust, because it's been so wrapped up with a certain culture of memory that I'm actually at least as interested in as what actually happened in the Holocaust. To me, what's also really fascinating and hardly studied at all is this phenomenon of the unbelievably rapid reemergence of Beis Yaakov in the DP camps. So there were, I don't know, 5 or 10 DP camps with Beis Yaakovs. There were DP camps that had multiple Beis Yaakovs. There were Beis Yaakov seminaries. There were Benos groups. And what we're talking about is basically a return to some kind of Beis Yaakov as family, which was the way I ended last week's class. And what you have here is kind of the quasi-familial relationships that were at the heart of the Beis Yaakov experience that paralleled the actual families of Sora Schneerer and of Beis Yaakov girls. So Beis Yaakov girls would leave their families and experience something like a family of girls and women with Sora Schneerer as the mother. I talked about that. This particular arrangement reproduces itself in the DP camps without actual family. In other words, many, if not most, of the girls and young women that you see in these photographs have no family. You're dealing with an orphan system that manages to reemerge with amazing force and amazing speed. So Beis Yaakov, despite the fact that a lot of the organizations that came into the DP camps and organized places like Fehrenwald, Bad Gadstein, those places assumed that the Orthodox Jews would no longer be Orthodox or would have some very minimal level of observance and didn't provide the kind of support for Orthodoxy that's these girls desired. And so that a lot of what you see, a lot of these pictures are showing a kind of self-help that Zionists or socialists didn't have to do themselves. They could rely on the American chaplains, whoever was coming in from the Joint Distribution Committee, to help them reorganize their lives. In the DP camps, Beis Yaakov and Benos groups emerged almost from the grassroots without the Aguda. The Aguda came in later. So that's one of the things that's of great interest to me. And what you see here on the left is the two images from the left are two photos. We have a lot of photos from one DP camp called Bad Gastein, which I think is in Austria. And I particularly love these images because they're clearly of Shabbos tables. And some of the women are married. You can see they cover their hair. But they're basically Shabbos tables with no men. Probably taken before Shabbos, or obviously taken before Shabbos. And there's one woman that I want to point out, actually the most beautiful woman, I think, in the photo. She's on the bottom, the top photo. She's in the first row that you see. There's first a child, and then the child's mother, and then that third woman, the third from the right woman, is a woman named Itka Ass, A-S-S. She's also on the bottom left of the other side of the Shabbos table, taken a different Shabbos because she's wearing a different dress. She's fairly famous in the history of the resistance. She was in the partisan group with the Bielski brothers, which was a partisan group that actually included Jewish men, women, and children, as opposed to other partisan groups that were just young people. But in the Bielski group, there was a much smaller group, somewhere between 5 and 10 people that were considered the kind of fighting core. And she was in the fighting core of the Bielski brothers group. And she actually had a revolver and apparently killed some Nazis. She was also in the Bielski brothers partisan group. Her nickname was the Tzadekis. So within and she was known, there were some non-Jews in that group. She was known as the Tzadekis by Jews and non-Jews alike in the group. And she was known that way because she continued to maintain some kind of religious observance under the conditions of living in the woods and being a member of a partisan group. Let me see what else I can say about this. It's interesting to see, somebody asked me last time about Zionism and Beis Yaakov, and I said there's all kinds of, Beis Yaakov was officially anti-Zionist, but there's all kinds of reasons to believe that they didn't just borrow a lot from Zionism, but sometimes we're sort of outrightly Zionist, and I'm wondering whether anyone thinks the Beis Yaakov flag, I forget which DP camp that is a kind of Zionist, very close to a Zionist flag there in the middle top. The picture on the right, if you can see, let me see if I can it's covered up for me. So I just want to point out my mother. So you see where it says Beis Yaakov Fehrenwald? That's 1946. Fehrenwald is a really interesting DP camp. It was the largest of the DP camps. It had, I don't know, between 5 and 10, I forget the exact numbers, you can look it up, but it was a whole city. All it had streets, the street names, the streets were named for American states, by the way. I looked at a map recently, and you know, there's like Vermont Street and Connecticut Street. So it's a really big DP camp, and not only did it have a B'nos group or multiple B'nos groups and a Beis Yaakov, it also had a kind of fledgling seminary, and it had satellite. It sent teachers off to various other DP camps in order to teach. So these women were real entrepreneurs, and I'll talk about this more in the same slide. They actually reached out to try to get help from the organized Jewish community. My mother's description of the DB camp was that the Beis Yaakov groups, the way you would divide the Beis Yaakov and B'nos groups is that there would be some for the sort of Hungarian, Transylvanian, Romanian arm of the branch of Beis Yaakov and B'nos, and some from Polish. So that tended to be, and that actually tended to be how marriages were arranged, the DP camps. And I told you that my parents met in Fehrenwald. My father was visiting a good activist who came to the DP camp, like many others did, and asked whether the girls needed any help. They'd actually gotten their act together before anybody showed up to help them. And that's how he first met my mother. At this point in 1946, how old would my mother be? She'd be 24 years old. She had already, this was already at this point, maybe the third or fourth Beis Yaakov school that she had helped run. And she continued to work in the Beis Yaakov of Paris, where she met my father again. And that's where they actually started dating. And there's no other way to describe it, because, these marriages are arranged without the help of parents, etc. So there's a kind of spirit about this moment in Beis Yaakov time that's of great interest to me. I'll just tell you one other thing about these women, B'nos groups, etc. One of their missions was to discover hidden children. And there were stories of Beis Yaakov teachers and girls sneaking into monasteries and kidnapping Jewish children back from where they'd been hidden by priests and things like that. So this is a really kind of amazing moment in Jewish history that's very little understood and studied. And it's one of my future plans is to understand more about this. So Beis Yaakov wasn't just in the DP camps. As a matter of fact, Beis Yaakov, both in its two present centers of Israel and North America, had already started in the 1930s. And even before that, there were schools that were both in Israel and the United States that were called Beis Yaakov, Beth Jacob, sometimes called Old Beis Yaakov in Israel, or Beth Jacob in the United States, that were kind of in the spirit of what was happening in Poland, but with no official connections. But in the 1930s, a school started in Tel Aviv, which had an official connection with the Polish Center, and a school started in 1933 in Tel Aviv, in 1937, I believe, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, by Vichna Kaplan. But there were also many, many more Beis Yaakovs all over the world, including the top center photo is Beis Yaakov of Shanghai, which is a Beis Yaakov that served the refugee community. The Mir Yeshiva and all those people that ended up in Shanghai, there was a Beis Yaakov that served them that operated into the 1950s. And by the way, Fehrenwald finally closed down in 1957. So some of these kind of immediate post-war experiments lasted quite a long time. In 1949, the Neshei Agudas Yisrael reconvened for the first time in Antwerp, not in what's now considered, it's Jerusalem or New York centers, but there were still enough Beis Yaakovs and enough Aguda activities all over Europe, including Czechoslovakia and Poland even had a Beis Yaakov. These were closed down by Soviet regimes pretty quickly. But what you see there is the Neshei Agudas Yisrael conference, which was held in 1949. And if you don't mind my pointing my mother out, she's sitting at the table, the second to the left, almost the last person on the left. She was actually the delegate from France. So there were national delegates, and my mother was at that point running a Beis Yaakov in Paris. What else can I say about it? The Beis Yaakov in these early years really considered itself in the 30s in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and New York. I think I already talked about the development of Beis Yaakov in Israel in the 30s. Did I, or am I misremembering?
I don't remember about.
Okay, so maybe I'll talk a little bit about. So Beis Yaakov started in the land of Israel, where it's called Beit Yaakov. It was called Beit Yaakov from the beginning, even though the old Beis Yaakov that was part of the Yeshuv was called Beis Yaakov. So they were more modern than the old Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov started in Tel Aviv in 1933 by Meir Sharansky, whose sister, Latka Sharansky, was a beloved teacher in the Krakow Seminary. And he had another teacher work with him who was also a graduate of the Krakow Seminary. They basically considered themselves an offshoot of the Beis Yaakov Seminary in Krakow. When later in Tel Aviv, they started a teacher seminary, they actually had a wall of the Beis Yaakov Teacher Seminary in Tel Aviv designed to look like the seminary building. The facade was modeled after the facade of the seminary building. So they considered themselves that they had, both in the United States and in the land of Israel, there were real obstacles for Beis Yaakov, much greater obstacles than the schools in Poland. So in Tel Aviv, the problem was, different problem in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, the Eda Haredis, the sort of ultra-Orthodox establishment, thought Beis Yaakov was too modern. In Tel Aviv, they thought it was too traditional. It had no obvious, they actually, and there's also no, Tel Aviv was growing at some crazy rate. It was really hard to get a space. Beis Yaakov Tel Aviv, originally, there was their headquarters. Their only facilities were two benches on Shderot Rothschild. So they actually only had park benches. They had no space. You couldn't get space in Tel Aviv. And they tried to make inroads into Jerusalem. They organized a speech and invited the mothers of the Orthodox world of Jerusalem to come to hear the speech. And the Eda Charedis shut them down because the idea of men speaking to women was too outrageous. How about a woman teaching? That's pretty, they wouldn't have liked that either. So all of this, they had to start from scratch again, and it took another year to get an agreement to get the first Beis Yaakov in Jerusalem started, founded by, I think his name was Hillel Lieberman. And then Lazer Friedenson, Eliezer Gershon Friedenson, the editor-in-chief of the Beis Yaakov Journal, came to Israel in 1935, to the land of Israel in 1935, did a kind of whistle-stop tour of all the Jewish settlements where there was any chance that you can get some Orthodox parents to send their daughters to a school, and it was a great success. And by 1936, there were, I don't know, 11 schools in the next year. So it grew very rapidly after that. And also the arrival of the first Benos kibbutz to Tel Aviv in 1934 made an impact. So suddenly you had a cadre of potential teachers, and Beis Yaakov in Israel was, in the land of Israel, was well underway by the late 1930s, and by now has completely and totally exploded. I just started this research, and our first job is to map Beis Yaakov, right? So just where is Beis Yaakov and how many are there? And my Israeli research assistant just sent me a couple of days ago an Excel sheet of over 1,000 Beis Yaakov or Beis Yaakov type schools. So Beis Yaakovs aren't all called Beis Yaakovs, and some of them are sort of loosely affiliated, like now Beis Rivka is loosely affiliated with Beis Yaakov, whereas Beis Rachel isn't. So Beis Yaakov is not an absolute category, but if you read Beis Yaakov somewhat generously, then there are over 1,000 Beis Yaakovs in the land of Israel. Beis Yaakov in the United States, totally different issue. Beis Yaakov in the United States had to deal with a kind of acculturating society, which, you know, Americanizing orthodoxy, that believed that it was plenty to just send your kid to a Talmud Torah after school, and there's no reason to turn them into a Rebbetzin, and they get a perfectly good education for free in public school. And why would we want to go back to our Eastern European ways? Those were the obstacles that were faced in Williamsburg by Vichna Kaplan in the 1930s. She actually started her Beis Yaakov with seven students, which is one of the things that is said about Beis Yaakov in Sarah Schneur's Beis Yaakov. There are different numbers. One of them is seven. And she very quickly started a dormitory, and she also had a kind of a summer program for her girls. And the reason why I mention this is that the first experiments of really doing Beis Yaakov basically saw Krakow as the heart and soul of Beis Yaakov. And the only way to go about doing things is by sheer imitation. So in every regard, the dormitory, the starting with the teacher seminary, the attempt to reach out, the summer programs where you learn under the beautiful skies of the Catskills. This is actually at a farm in Connecticut, an Orthodox farm in Connecticut. These were all deliberately modeled on Sarah Schneur's own experience. I think even anybody who went to Beis Yaakov, you know, who went to Beis Yaakov in the 60s and 70s the way I did, and 80s or whatever, their basic reaction is going to be, all those girls have such short sleeves. Sneas. So it's very hard not to talk about Besyakov then, and Besyakov in the interwar period, and the immediate post-war period in Besyakov today, without making note of one very obvious thing, which is that Besyakov now is so much more strict, so much more, I mean, these pictures are shocking, and actually the picture on the bottom middle, I got from a kind of post by Leslie Ginsberg Klein. She must have taught for you guys, right? If she didn't, she should. So Leslie Mark Shapiro talks about this too, the troubling trend of photoshopping history. This is a photo that was, when it appeared in a more recent Besyakov publication, the girl's sleeves were brought down to their wrists to make them more tsneistic. So Leslie Klein believes that we shouldn't try to Photoshop history. So this is not the Photoshop picture. This is the original, though torn, picture of what a Besyakov girl looked like in the late 40s or mid 40s. I'm not entirely sure what the date is there. So one question is, how did all that change? And obviously there are many, many answers to, you know, what is different about, you know, on one hand, these experiments and outside the centers of Besyakov are trying to recreate something of the spirit of Besyakov. At the same time, it's really very, very different kind of system, to the point where when I was doing my research on the interwar Besyakov, I just was continually surprised at how worldly it was, at how radical it was, etc. All these things that I talked about in earlier sessions. And one of the many ways of thinking about what it was in this early post-war period, just like in the period during the wars, it was what Stacy Rigler calls an interventionist movement. So it was a movement that was trying, and I at some point called it a Balchuva movement, actually. It was trying to take a society in crisis and intervene within it to bring Jewish girls back to orthodoxy. And in order to do that, it had to appeal to Jewish girls, it had to attract Jewish girls, it had to package its messages for them in new ways. In the post-war period, I think it's fair to say that the movement is more a movement of retrenchment. Basically, the movement is trying to slowly build on its enormous gains. I mean, it's enormously successful, and it's just trying to protect its territory. And even in the sense, I already told you that in the interwar period, there were girls from totally irreligious families that were in Besyakov schools. In present day Besyakov, you could get kicked out of the seminary for having a smartphone. Or in other words, if your family shows some sign of being less than entirely, in other words, schools, you can get kicked out of schools for not being firm enough. And there's no sense of, well, let's keep them with us, let's do Kiruv. That's especially true in the schools in urban centers where there are many schools to choose from, and each school kind of guards its own turf and serves a particular demographic and tries to keep its status high by having, you know, particularly from families or etc. So that's one way it's really different. And the other way it's really different is which I think is maybe even more dramatic, is the difference between a society in which men go all out to create, support, approve of a system that teaches girls Torah, and now a system in which women and girls are taught to understand that their role is to support men in their Torah study. So what I'm talking about is the revolution in Orthodox Jewish life, which is called Chevrat Lomdim sometimes, or the Kolel system, or the fact that some really huge percentage, much, much higher than in any other time in Orthodox history, some huge percentage of men are expected to, as we say, sit and learn after they they're married. And what this requires is women who are willing to support them or willing to put up with this or however you think of this. And that particular confluence of social transformations is usually attributed to the Chazon Ish, Avram Yehoshua Karelitz, who a kind of leader in the ultra-Orthodox world, especially around Bnei Barak and Jerusalem, he died in 1953, who worked with a Beis Yaakov principal named Avram Yehoshua Wolf, a German Jew. As I said, very often it's the slightly more modern men that are given the job of dealing with women, a certain kind of type that's given the job. And it was understood, okay, a Yekka, he could work with the women. He started a seminary, but what he did is really, which is still, is, I think it's run by his son now, Tzvi Wolf. And Avram Yehoshua Wolf decided that he was gonna challenge the young women in his seminary to marry a yeshiva boy who sits and learns after he marries. And for whatever reason, he was successful. He also believed that the curriculum of Beis Yaakov should be toned down, that the kind of intellectual ambition that was a marker of especially the seminary education in the interwar period, the pride of the seminary, that was no longer necessary, that we should go back to, that was a sign of the times, a sign of the danger of assimilation, of radical youth movements, of conversion. You had to cater to women's intellectual ambitions, and now you no longer do, and you're only going to create frustrated housewives if you give them too much Torah. And so the curriculum was transformed and toned down, though it still remains quite ambitious in many other parts of the Beis Yaakov movement. But he created a kind of type of Beis Yaakov, which became a kind of ideal model, which is that in Beis Yaakov, you basically are instilled with the value of male Torah study. And at this, during this period of the growth of Beis Yaakov, this system that was worked out by Rav Wolf, based on the kind of principles of the Chazon Ish, that women can support their men while they study, was actually enabled by certain developments in the new state of Israel, including partial funding for Orthodox schools, Chinuch Atzmai, and the explosion of Beis Yaakov's meant that basically Orthodox graduates of Beis Yaakov seminaries could almost be guaranteed jobs in the growing Beis Yaakov movement. And a whole confluence of factors, economic, social, whatever, contributed to the possibility of this society of learners. I didn't actually say that maybe I'll get to it in the next slide. Let me move on. Maybe I'll talk about this slide for a minute. So Beis Yaakov, another very major difference between Beis Yaakov in the interwar period and Beis Yaakov after the war, is that Beis Yaakov in the interwar period had a central office. It had one symbolic figurehead, if you want to call it that. It had a woman. It had a journal. Toward the end of the interwar period, it actually had two. The Lithuanian branch of the system had the Beis Yaakov Ruf, call of the Beis Yaakov. In the post-war period for about a decade or two, Beis Yaakov continued to have a journal in Hebrew called the Beit Yaakov Journal, Yarchon Beit Yaakov. I just bought a bunch of these on auction. For $100, I got all these Beshakov Yarchonim, and I'm going to upload them to my website, and then anybody will be able to read them. And in it also had a central office, and it has a central office in New York, I think until the early 70s when they were sued, run by someone named Shimon Newhouse. And there was a court suit. Somebody drowned in a Beis Yaakov pool, and they just went out of business, I think, just to avoid having to. So there, both centers had some kind of organized office. They had some kind of, the Beis Yaakov Journal in English was called Beth Jacob. It was both in Hebrew and in English, and I'm looking for it on the web. So it had, and Beis Yaakov into our period also had a publishing house. So it no longer, Beis Yaakov no longer has many of those things, including it no longer has a central office. It no longer has, in other words, anyone could start a Beis Yaakov and call it a Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov is like a franchise where you don't have to pay anybody. And you just participate. It's kind of, anybody who wants could start a Beis Yaakov. There's, after the 70s and 80s, no longer a central Beis Yaakov journal. There is Beis Yaakov literature. There's even a sort of orthodox version of the Babysitter Club called the Beis Yaakov Times. The main character's name is Chani. But there's nothing like a Beis Yaakov publishing house. And I think that's part of one of the reasons that it took, you know, me to translate Sereshner's work into English and to make it widely available. So there's some loss of that comes from the fact that there's no longer a center. In North America, Beis Yaakov was also loosely organized under the Aguda umbrella, Torah and Masorah, but there are many other types of schools that are under that umbrella. So Michael raised his hand. Did I make a mistake? Maybe he wants to. I'm sure I made a mistake.
Go on, go on.
Not my mistake. I know I'm making a mistake.
We'll worry about anything later. Just go on. We'll worry about the class.
So one of the things that's particularly that at some point I just wanted to bring up as I said I wasn't going to talk about Beis Yaakov and the Holocaust, because Beis Yaakov and the Holocaust really requires a very particular kind of analysis, because so much of Beis Yaakov memory is so mythologized, and really this is should be the subject of a book. So a lot of Beis Yaakov's memory of the Holocaust is related to, maybe I'll start with that. On the bottom right, you see a letter from the Beis Yaakov teachers of Bergen-Belsen. So some Beis Yaakov teachers found themselves in Bergen-Belsen, which was actually a DP camp after it was a concentration camp. And it had people from all kinds of, in other words, it wasn't just the people who had been in the concentration camp. It was a kind of center. And they found themselves in Bergen-Belsen DP camp with American quote unquote Orthodox chaplain who didn't understand who they were, who didn't understand how strictly they were keeping kosher. This is a letter that they sent out to the Orthodox world, like, save us. We didn't go through what we went through in order to become some kind of weak form of progressive American Orthodox or some sort of slightly religious Mizrahi Zionist. They were actually saying, are there any other people like us out there? Help. But the reason why I chose to include this little snippet is to remind myself to talk about how I think this is the beginning of a kind of myth about, by myth I just mean pious story, I'm not saying it's not true, about that Orthodox Jews maintain their purity, whatever that means, in the Holocaust, and in particular that they made for Orthodox Jewish women, that they maintain their sexual purity. And a lot of Orthodox Holocaust memory revolves around a story, and this story was publicized in the New York Times, and some of you may know about it. It's a very big part of Beis Yaakov Holocaust commemoration. It could be argued even sex education. of 93 Beis Yaakov girls from the Krakow Seminary who killed themselves rather than be taken as prostitutes. The New York Times article got the story wrong. It wasn't Warsaw, but Krakow. And they said they managed to send the last letter, and there's a Hebrew translation of the last letter. And I'll just point out that the translations, and, you know, I don't know whether you'll ever receive this letter. And it talks about what happened. We're 93 girls between the ages of 14 and 22. You can see the last line is, very soon we will be with our mother, Sarah. And this story has been more or less conclusively determined to be a fiction. Maybe there's a few holdouts. I don't have any skin in the game on, you know, whether it is or it isn't, but it's, in any case, it was incredibly well known and spread. There's a street in Tel Aviv named after the 93. There were plays and poems written about it. All kinds of rabbis spoke about this. Beis Yaakov itself raised money, you know, on behalf of the 93 who were already dead. They certainly part of a kind of attempt to inspire Beis Yaakov girls through the story of the 93 is very deeply embedded into Beis Yaakov culture. And whether this has something to do with, and it's also connected to the memory of Beis Yaakov. So the whole letter is about, we will be reunited with Sarah Schneira. Sarah Schneira died in 1935. And yet she's brought into Holocaust memory. So Orthodox Holocaust memory is incredibly complicated, and to find at the heart of the female version this weird story that's slightly pornographic is also interesting. And I won't say more than that. To vanquish the dragon is part of what I would call a kind of the genre of Orthodox women maintaining not only their Torah observance, but also their purity under the worst conditions is now a big part of how the Orthodox world commemorates the Holocaust in all of its variations. And Beis Yaakov is, for whatever complicated sociological reason, psychological reason, is at the heart of this story. And I'm not gonna analyze that now. We could talk about it if people have questions. So I've already described how Beis Yaakov is different today than it was in the interwar period. In the interwar period, it was all about male enthusiasm for female Torah study. That's almost reversed itself in some way. But I think some of the recent controversies around Beis Yaakov tell you something about the character, and I'll just throw them out there so you know that they exist and you'll tell me what they mean or think about them on your own. And one of the, just in sort of random order, there's the kind of the issue of Beis Yaakov of Emmanuel, which was Beit Yaakov of Emmanuel, which was a controversy that hit in 2007 and wasn't resolved till 2010 or even later. And was about a Beis Yaakov in a settlement called Emmanuel, the town really now, in which the a wall was built between a kind of fabric covered fence that separated the, depending on which way you look at it, either the less Orthodox from the more Orthodox girls or the Sephardic girls from the Ashkenazic girls. And somebody complained, and the Supreme Court called this a racist act, and a bunch of parents from the more Orthodox side of the Beis Yaakov school protested, and there were huge protests, and when they were taken off to jail, they were taken off to jail for two weeks. They were like carried on the backs of 100,000 ultra-Orthodox men. And people pointed out so there were Sephardic parents among the ultra-Orthodox group. So it couldn't be, I'll just throw that out there. So it couldn't be described as just racism. So leaving aside the elements of this, to me, it's a big distinction from the interwar period, in which Beis Yaakov prided itself on being a category that transcended the divisions of the Polish Orthodox world. So the fact that there were Hasidish and Misnagdish families represented, the fact that there were, you know, even modern Orthodox families, that was something that Beis Yaakov took great pride in. Beis Yaakov was a kind of, I sometimes talk about it as pan-Hasidic. Sarah Schneer enjoyed that diversity and unity. And Beis Yaakov actually constituted a category in its own that didn't neatly fit into all the other categories that are so, that so rely on male institutions or figures. Hasidism, who's the male Rebbe you follow, or yeshiva, which yeshiva do you go to? Yeshivish, Misnagdish. Beis Yaakov was its own thing. And this idea that the own thing that was Beis Yaakov has now given way to a school with a fence down the middle, or as you can see, Beis Yaakov de Chasidei Gur, the Gur, which was actually the primary feeder of Beis Yaakov in the interwar period, where the Rebbe was proud to send his daughter to the seminary, now has their own Beis Yaakov. I think that's sort of symptomatic of the kind of fracturing of, I don't know if it's Beis Yaakov or of Orthodox life or however you think about it. But to me, there was something beautiful about what we called in Beis Yaakov, Achdus. And, you know, for Achdus we shall live, right? And Achdus hasn't completely disappeared, right? There's the Beis Yaakov convention where they create a song with girls singing in 12 different places, all singing Beis Yaakov songs. So it's not gone, but it's being chipped away by aspects of Orthodox life that were not indigenous to it in the interwar period. The other thing is the Shidduch crisis. I started this by talking about the crisis. Ooh, 613. It's 613 right now. That's a holy Jewish number. So let me just very quickly go through this. The Shidduch crisis is almost the opposite of the conditions under which Beis Yaakov became legitimized, right? A crisis of female defection. Now it's a crisis of overabundance of Orthodox girls that are looking for boys to marry, and there's an imbalance there. And I know there's huge amounts of stuff written about it, but I just want to point out to the role of Beis Yaakov in emerging from one type of crisis and helping to create another crisis by its very success. That if there were, you know, I think I talked about this earlier, so I'll leave that behind. The higher education crisis is the new question of the economic model by which graduates of Beis Yaakov could immediately be slotted into jobs in the Orthodox world because the Orthodox world was growing. You're now dealing with another economic problem, which is the saturation of the Orthodox market and the problem that you've created the society of learners without jobs the way there were in the beginning. And how are we going to find jobs for Orthodox women without having them risk going to a secular school? Bagrut. This is a problem mostly in Israel, but it also has manifestations in the United States. Feminist revisionism, Beis Yaakov guarding itself from the feminists who try to insist that it's feminist and who use Sarah Schneer as a role model for women's prayer groups or Talmud study or all kinds of things that the Orthodox world deems not kosher. The term feminist revisionism is not Nussan Wolpin, the editor of the Jewish Observer, and the legitimacy crisis, which I think is actually not really a crisis. It rears its head from time to time. It's, do we still have permission? Do girls still have permission to study Torah at a high level if there's no conversion problem? If there's no conversion, if mostly girls are staying from, then how do we legitimate them studying at the high level that they're studying? So that's a legitimacy crisis. I'll also just say that Beis Yaakov maybe returned to the outset, which is that on one hand, Beis Yaakov is moving very far away from its interwar roots. On the other hand, it can't live without the memory of Intihor Bes Yaakov, even if it misremembers it, and even if it doesn't entirely tell correct stories about things. The thing that connects Bes Yaakov girls together as sisters, that makes people call themselves great-granddaughters of Sarah Schneer because they're students of a student of Sarah Schneer. This way in which Bes Yaakov creates Orthodox women across many differences and huge borders as related, as relatives, as kith and kin, not only persists, but is even getting stronger. The Memorial Foundation, there is a Memorial Foundation. Memorial culture around Bes Yaakov, visits to the seminary, visits to Poland, the way in which Sarah Schneer and interwar period function to keep Bes Yaakov is not only persisting but getting stronger. And the function of the memory of the interwar period is something that I'm also very interested in researching. And that's all I'll say for now, because I want to hear your questions.
Okay, you want me, I'll go over the questions for you?
Okay, if I stop sharing? So maybe I'll be able to see them then.
Okay, you can unshare, yeah, if you'd like.
Oh, and then I get to see all kinds of people.
That's it, there we go. Okay, all right. If you want to go, I'll go through them for you, it'll make it easier. Somebody pointing out her mother was in the first graduating class. And if there are any pictures from Warsaw, the first graduating class of Bes Yaakov school, not the seminary, from Warsaw. I don't know if you know if there are any questions like that. Okay, kids, I guess.
In other words, have I come across, I actually have yet to come across a photo of Bes Yaakov of Warsaw. I have a fabulous story from the Bes Yaakov of Warsaw. So if that's of appeals, I can share that. Or, sure. You know, you could go to my website and find it.
You can, if we can take
a... Bes Yaakov of Warsaw is... did I share this before about the story of Bes Yaakov girls make a movie?
Not a movie. You talked about a play. You didn't talk about movies. Movies are us, sir. How can they go...
So I'm going through the Warsaw press looking for stories about Bes Yaakov with the full understanding that half the stories I'm going to read are total... It's like The Onion. Bes Yaakov was just a source of jokes for a lot of the journalists. But, you know, you find out stuff from jokes too. And I come across the story and it says, Bes Yaakov to make movies. Bes Yaakov girls to become movie stars. And the story is so plausible that it's clearly from an insider. And I read the whole thing before I could figure out that it wasn't, that I shouldn't believe it. So the story was that a bunch of Aguda activists came to, Warsaw had a few Bes Yaakovs. One of them was on Tvarda Street. I don't know, did this person's mother go to the one on Tvarda Street?
I do not know.
Okay, so they come to the one on Tvarda Street. I think that was the big one in Warsaw. And they're there to test the girls, and the girls perform beautifully, wonderfully. They know Rashi, they know how to daven, everything. And then one of them, just as they're leaving, one of the good activists says, so, and who's the most famous woman in the world? And the expected answer is Sarah Schneer. And one of them says, Hannah something, who's a Polish movie star of the era. And the teacher looks stricken and, I'm sorry, I got the story wrong. She says, Greta Garbo. And the teacher looks stricken and she thinks, oh, maybe I was supposed to say a Polish movie star. So then she says, Hannah, whatever. That's the wrong answer. The right answer is Sarah Schneer, not some movie star. So the activists walk out of the school and they say to each other, there's an emergency meeting. What are we going to do? The Bes Yaakov girls, yeah, they're learning how to daven, and they're learning how, but they're clearly going to the movies, and we have to find we have to make kosher movies for them because they're movie crazy. This is also plausible, if you know Basyakov culture, the idea that you create a kosher variation of the treif thing is totally Basyakov, right? That was like the way they thought. So what do they do? Who do they commission a script from? So then it continues to be totally plausible. They commission a script from Sershner. Of course, who else? She wrote 7 Basyakov plays that I know of. Who else would they do it? And they send Tovia Horowitz to America to raise money for the movie. Exactly. Who else would they send and where would they send him? And apparently he comes back and there's plenty of funding. And Sershner produces her script. And the script is the story of the Bach's daughter. And if anyone who knows Serge Nera, they know she's a descendant of the Bach. I mean, this person got every detail right. It's the story of the, the Yevon Metzula, the Gzeros Tachvatat, the Chmelnytsky massacres. It's a story in there. And it's about a girl who, since it's a sort of kosher story, it's kind of a kosher version of the story of the king that falls in love with a non-Jewish, with a Jewish woman, and she's secret. It's like the Esther story, but it's a sort of kosher version. They got that exactly right too. And then it says that the Basyakov cast all the members of this movie, all the roles. And then Sarshner decided that it would take place in the land of Israel and in Poland, totally appropriately. And it then says, and she set sail to the land of Israel to scout locations. And anybody who knows anything about Sarah Schneerin knows that she was desperate to go to Israel, to the land of Israel, her whole life. And she never made it there. That was her big, sad truth. And that's when I was like, okay, this didn't actually happen. Until then, I was so excited that I was going to, in some archive somewhere, I was going to find an actual Basyakov movie from the interwar period. Unfortunately not.
All right. Shoshana wants to know that the letter, right, I think that is a general consensus of everybody. The 93 girls was a myth. And so is the letter a forgery? The letter they're going to be with Sarah, where does that letter come from?
I actually think that the fact that Basyakov was raising funds from people who were fighting the international white slave trade, that whole story about prostitution, might explain something about that letter. That, in other words, the fundraising, the circulation of stories about prostitution or whatever, I don't think calling it a forgery is exactly right. I mean, you know, there are these pious myths that are not true, but forgery is so judgmental. I don't think we exactly have the term for how to talk about this. In other words, it may never have happened without actually being somebody, I don't know, a man sort of. In other words, it's a pious fiction, which pious literature allows for such pious fictions. I don't know. I don't like calling it a forgery or a fraud or anything like that. I don't think it's, and I think it's just not accurate to where it came from, though who knows where it came from. Supposedly my father knew where it came from and he refused to say, but whenever it was, anybody would bring up that story, you know, Basyakov, you encounter it all the time. He would say, don't listen to that. No, Narishkeiten, you know, Narishkeiten. He hated it. So that's another reason why I'm happy to be in the camp that says it never happened.
Yeah, I mean,
I think we need descriptors that are between actual history and fraud.
Okay, I mean, I know all societies create myths about their founding. I mean, that's a common thing, and this, you know, it gives a certain solidarity and in group. But okay, we mentioned about Gehr splitting up. I think you mentioned one of your earlier classes, Gehr was really the supporters of Basyakov. And then I pointed out Gehr is splitting off because a little bit of the sexual issues of those who know the Gehr or Rebbe, they have very, very strict, way stricter than the halacha demands. And they're splitting off from the Basyakov, so they shouldn't have to marry, quote unquote, regular boys who won't follow the Gehr restriction. Do you have any comments on that?
Right. Gehr and Slonim. So part of the kind of move to the right has been this kind of taking on of new intense sexual practices. You know, you don't call your wife by her name, you don't walk beside her, I mean, and rules about sex. I think that this would have been just totally out of place in the interwar period. And I think part of it, I really think that if I were a real economist, as opposed to pretending to be one, I think an economic analysis would help explain some of these trends.
Interesting. Okay, so that's a very interesting, the role of non-Frum, if they allow any, or non-Jewish, you know, teachers in Beis Yaakov today. We know, for example, in the Hirshian schools, they didn't allow everybody had to be Frum, even the math teacher. But in Beis Yaakov today,
even the math teacher has to be Frum. That's a problem finding a math. If you're going to teach serious math, like, you know, where are you going to find a Frum guy who knows anything past like right. one division?
Yeah, but I'm saying that was, does Beis Yaakov today allow any non-Frum Jews in the secular subject? I have no idea, actually, that.
My guess is it's not, when I was, I went to a kind of, you know, what I didn't say is that there's still certain sort of experimental Beis Yaakovs. They tend to be in, right, they don't, certainly not non-Frum women, but non-Frum men might be, for secular subjects, might be a different. I had a non-Frum male teacher in a kind of Wild West Beis Yaakov. Like there's places. Oh, I didn't show you. In other words, I went to a brand new Beis Yaakov that was in a neighborhood in Queens that didn't have a Beis Yaakov. So sometimes the ones that are, that was because I got kicked out of the Beis Yaakov in Borough Park, but maybe that's TMI. But when they're off in the, you know, what they're called out of town Beis Yaakov, that wasn't so bad. The year after I was in that BYA, that was Beis Yaakov Academy, they kicked out the whole entire class. Like a year or two after me. But in out-of-town Beis Yaakovs, as they're called, they are sometimes looser. And in other words, the rules for what goes in a Beis Yaakov in Lakewood, which is the fastest growing Beis Yaakov, or in Brooklyn or in Queens even. Queens was like a little bit of the Wild West of Beis Yaakov. So you can do, they were wilder. So I experienced Beis Yaakov, fortunately, in two of its variations. In a slightly wilder, looser way. And they're more tolerant, they're more diverse. The truth is, I went to Beis Yaakov a long time ago, so all kinds of things are changing. The whole Orthodox world is getting so ramified. There are people with PhDs who can teach a science class, who, you know, or from, and you don't have to make those choices anymore.
Can I ask quickly why they would kick out an entire class from Beis Yaakov?
I'm trying to remember, like, what awful thing they did. Shoshana, you know what I'm talking about? Leslie knows. I read it in Leslie's. They used to have non-Frum teachers. Oh, Montreal. Montreal is a whole other story. You know, you go to small Jewish communities, and it's these big communities where they slice and dice it up, you know, to the extent that they do, that you can end up someplace that uptight. But I think there was, I don't, you know, why do they kick girls out of Beis Yaakov? They kick girls out of Beis Yaakov for talking to boys in the pizza store. It was probably
that's
to kick like that.
A girl out of Beis Yaakov.
Fancy heresies.
Yeah. But to click an entire class. No, I understand the girl gets kicked out for talking to the boy in the pizza parlor, but kick out an entire class.
Redemption.
Maybe they all went to the pizza store. I don't know. But okay. It's
we all went to the pizza store.
Yeah. Okay, you know, I'll unmute people in a moment. So if anybody really wants to say anything, just you'll be unmuted automatically. So be careful. Okay. Really, I want to thank you.
Maybe
I
need to.
Okay, I'll mute everybody. I'll unmute you in 1 second. I just want to thank really Dr. Simon for really four fascinating weeks on the history of Beis Yaakov, so many interesting from the beginning, and the nuance, and really and the sensitivity I think how you deal with the issue and the objectivity of an academic scholar, which we always love, but the warmth and when someone from comes in the world. So I want to thank you very much on behalf of everybody. And we look forward, like I said, please God, in the future to having other opportunities to learn together. And of course, we have many opportunities to learn together tomorrow morning. Of course, Ari Zivitovsky doing his second part on animals and halakha. Totally different subject matter. Interesting in a very different way. And as I mentioned at the beginning, before many of you were here, you saw in the email, we're starting next Monday on July 6th, 24 classes over 8 weeks on Tanakh. Everyone taught by different really amazing teachers. These are all experts in Tanakh, and I hope we'll see many of you and invite your friends and register. You're going to still be a different password. And that's it. Now I'll unmute everybody if anyone wants to say hello or ask any questions. But really, thank you very much. And pleasure to see everybody. Everybody should be well and healthy. And we should meet on good occasions. You know, I'm meeting lots of people on Zoom. I see them on the screen. But one day, please God, we should meet for half